Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's September 21st, 2012. You listen to the best poker cast in the world. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long, not coming to you via video. An amazing week this has been, right?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable, and you know we'll get to all that later about Howard Lederer and stuff. But it's just wow. I have so many questions about it, so I don't want to do it now. We're going to talk about the Howard Lederer video interviews for the main topic today. But I did a lot of watching of other things as well this week, and I feel like now almost every week I'm going to have this sort of World Series on ESPN update. Because there's always something on the show that irks me or whatever, but...
You're the Ante Up Nation's official couch potato.
Yes, exactly. You know, I have to... We do the call the floor thing all the time, and you know, we had mentioned one of those, that really, really big blow-up hand during the Players' Championship that took 45 minutes to figure out and all that. We talked about that on the show, but there was another instance where I'm not exactly sure if I agree with the ruling or not. Everyone who followed the World Series this year remembers Gail Bauman, who was one of the women that was the chip leaders for a lot of the tournament and just missed making the final table. This is way on the outside table. It wasn't a feature table or anything, but it's one of those things where the camera crew runs out there and tries to record it for posterity. So she's under the gun, I believe, and she raises. This is day five now, and she's a massive chip leader. She raises to 60,000, and it folds around to the small blind, who shoves for 1.39 million or something, which to me is hilarious. I'm sorry, but
it's totally pocket aces.
Yeah, and what ends up happening, you'll find out why he did that. The big blind folds, and the small blind mucks, thinking the hand is over, which is probably the reason why he went all in for 1.3 million, thinking he was the first to act. Because everyone else had folded, he was going to be, you know, it was going to be just him and the big blind, and you know the big blind probably had some small stack or something, so it didn't matter that he went all in. And so he mucks his cards, and then Bauman's sitting there like, "Hello, I'm still here. I raised under the gun, and I call." Well, the guy mucked his cards, and tournament poker, you have to show your hand at when it's the final hand of, you know, a tournament or whatever. You have to, you know, if you're all in. And so, to me, when they get there with the cameras, it looks like they were trying to retrieve his hand, but they couldn't find his cards in the muck, which I think is interesting by itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the floor comes over, and he's like, "Well, we can't find his cards, and in the interest of, you know, the spirit of the tournament and fair play and everything, we're going to make him just pay the $60,000 to her, which is her initial raise, because we couldn't fish his cards out of the muck and have him play the hand that he was dealt." And then he says, "You can look it up. It's Rule 89. I don't know how I feel about this. It's not her fault that this guy didn't pay attention and mucked his hand.
Yes.
I don't understand that. Now, the other problem would be, no, and it wouldn't be a problem, because if she had fewer chips than he did, then he would just pay her off, double her up, and then whatever he has left over, he gets to keep playing, but he has sacrificed that hand on my part. I don't feel like this guy deserves a second chance. I feel bad that he didn't see her raise or know she raised, but his responsibility in this game is to pay attention to everything, and the rule is, if your cards touch the muck, they're dead. How come they're not dead in this situation, but they are in every other situation? Why can't we fish him out of the muck for all the other situations then?" Right?
I think that's your first point, is that we've got to get off of this Billy Bass boat fishing the flats crap. that we watch on Sun Sports at 6 a.m. on Sunday in poker tournaments. You know, there should never be any fishing out of the muck. You know, the muck should be like the hottest lava at the center of the earth. You know, as soon as your cards touch it, they evaporate. Because it just, I mean, it opens up so many other problems. I mean, so many other problems. And, we got a call the floor email this week, and it'll be on the show, you know, in a couple months probably because of our backup. But, you know, the situation real quickly was, you know, big blind saying, hey, that card flashed. I saw that card, the small blind, it's an ace. And so they ended up turning over the cards, and there was no ace. It was an 8 and a 9.
Yeah.
Completely wrong. And so, I mean, you just can't be doing this stuff. You can't go fishing. I mean, if it's in the muck, it's gone. That's it. That's done. So, I mean, when I initially read this, then I'm like, you know what? I don't see there's any way that you can't rule how they did. You know, give him the 60K. That's what she committed, the pot. You know, obviously he went outlandish, but he doesn't have cards now. He loses. He can't win. She gets paid her 60,000. But I think you're right. I mean, by not committing him to put in the 1.3 million, you're inviting people to take weird shots all the time.
Exactly.
And saying, well, as soon as somebody calls, oh, wait, hold it. Oh, my hands are gone. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm in the muck.
Yeah, darn shucks. You know, I really did want you to call that 1.3 million, but I don't have cards now. So here's your 60,000. Have fun.
Plus, they say, oh, what was your hand? Now you can lie about your hand. Yeah. Oh, it was ace-ace. Oh, why'd you muck it? Oh, I thought the hand was over. No, you said it. You know, now it just creates this havoc. Oh, it's just crazy. It's just absolutely crazy to me. And the other thing, too, is okay, so you let him stay in that tournament if you want to say in the spirit of the tournament. Okay, well, in the spirit of the tournament, you've just disenfranchised Gail Bowman. And now she also should get the benefit of his raise, at least minimum. That she should at least get another 60,000, which is the minimum raise there, because he called out all in. He raised. There was a raise made. Mm-hmm. You know, if it doesn't felt him, then he should have to at least pay that penalty, and she should get it because he has no cards to show to earn the pot. I just feel like there's a lot of things wrong with that. And there may be other tournament directors who would hear this and be like, you know, no, you got to understand this is why it's done this way. I don't feel that way. As a player, your response, if you can throw at me, oh, you have to be responsible for X, X, and X, then why is it now not responsibility? You know, it doesn't make any sense because his life was on the line. That's not right. You can't have that shades of gray in that, you know? I mean, I realize there's rule one, which says, you know, you do what's best for the game or whatever, but that's not right. It's not right, and it opens up everything else to interpretation then.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely interested in people that do this for a living and their thoughts. I mean, obviously, we're just a couple knuckleheads that play cards and have our opinion. I wonder, and I can't imagine anybody ever ruling this way, but I wonder if a solution to this is to run the board out. She has 7 cards, he has 5 cards. Oh. Because he's in peril. I mean, yeah. To me, that's the only thing that really makes this a little tricky, is that he was going to be out of the tournament, right? If he was forced to call this 1.3 million, right?
Right. If he lost.
Oh, yeah, at least give him the option to stay in the tournament, but he has to hope that he can play the board and chop.
Yeah.
You know, again, I think that's kind of outlandish, so I'm not certainly suggesting that. But, I mean, that's the problem here. If he wasn't going to be eliminated here, you know, if he had her covered, then I think it's a little different story. But I wonder if that's what played into it. I didn't watch it, and you did. But I wonder if some other people will mention that, too, that it does get tricky when you're eliminating somebody from a tournament without cards.
Yeah. It's to me, I just, and even I'm watching it with Jean, and she's like, and she doesn't even play anymore. You know what I mean? She plays, you know, with the family or something like that once in a while, but she doesn't even really watch a lot of poker anymore and doesn't even play that much anymore. And she was just, it was just outlandish to her. She's like, that is not right. And so when someone who just doesn't really play that much anymore watches it and feels like it's wrong, how can the people who actually make the rules think it's not wrong?
Well, and the other thing, too, this is, I know it's a real problem with our listeners, our listeners have a real problem with this, with the call to the floor, this constant reminding that the player is responsible for everything. Mm. You can't count on the dealer, you can't count on other players, everything has got to be up to you. And here's a case where, guess what, it's not really up to you.
Yeah.
And as a player, if I'm constantly told by tournament directors and floor people that, oops, sorry, you didn't know there was a raise, that money's got to stay in, or whatever these rulings are. Or, I'm sorry, the dealer miscounted the chips, you still got to call the $1.3 million instead of the $130,000. I would be livid at this, because now there's a, oh, okay, well, in this case, you know, yeah, we're not gonna hold you to that.
Right.
I mean, it's got to be consistent, right? And that's always the big thing in poker is consistency. And
the other thing the guy said to the floor was that because she didn't call right away, that there was a chance for him to muck his cards. And first of all, there's no rule that says she has to call right away. She could have had a decision to make. That makes no difference whether or not she called right away or not. And she said she did call right away.
Yeah.
You know.
In a philosophical standpoint, I totally agree. But you know, there is a difference between I call, oh, I now muck, versus I muck. Okay, well, he doesn't have a hand anymore. Well, yeah, sure, I call.
Right.
You know, there is a subtle difference there. Now, I don't know what that changes.
Right, yeah. And but they're trying to put some sort of onus on her, like she was responsible for the reason why he folded.
Onus on her.
Felt like just, it.
Well, yeah.
But, the way he described it to her, it felt like it.
It's a reflection of, again, that difference of, I mean, who in the world would not call $1.3 million when they're the only one with live cards?
Right.
You know, I mean, there's just no, it's illogical to think somebody wouldn't say, oh, okay, I fold. but it's completely different if someone calls and then in the midst of the calling, cards are flying into the muck and stuff, but. At the end of the day, this is the small blinds problem. You know, you should have paid attention to the action, and at the very least, should have held on to his cards until the pot been pushed to him. I didn't watch it. I mean, had the pot been pushed to him?
No. The dealer didn't do anything wrong. I mean, it was basically small blind, big blind. I'm all in. But big blind folds. He mucks his cards, thinking the hand's over, and doesn't even realize she has the cards. And she says, "I call."
And I'm not inclined to have any sympathy at all with the small blind in this case.
Me neither. Unbelievable. So anyway, just tune in next week. I'll probably have something else to bitch about. We do have a hotline, 813-448-1120. This one comes from Doug from Minneapolis.
Get everybody who you normally get to do on the cruise, get them around the table, get some of those, whatever omnidirectional microphones you can get, and just have a BS session one night, you guys playing cards, and do it that way. That way you have the logistics handled. You got people who want to be there. And it's totally kosher.
Doug is not the first one to suggest that the Superfan show be recorded on a cruise ship.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I've had a couple other folks. And so here's the deal, though. We're going to do the Superfan show. We're going to record it next week. It's not going to be posted for a couple weeks. We'll talk more about that in the housekeeping part of the show. But we will, depending on how it goes, and I have a good feeling. I like how it's kind of shaping up right now. Well, there's no reason for us not to do one on a cruise ship if we have enough participation. And I think we will for the Baltimore cruise coming up. So we'll see, and maybe do it that way. But obviously, this would be much easier if we had a lot more PokerCast listeners on our cruises, right?
Yes, that's true.
Because then you could, you know, and then it's truly a super fan show. I mean, we can't just do it with just a couple, so... You know, so I guess the dog, you know, call me maybe.
I've also thought about this during our home game, and I'm sure you have as well. I really felt like, you know, we should just have a recorder there and like a mic hanging over the table, and then just it records everything. And then at the end, you know, if we have time, as long as we like can tell each other, hey, that was pretty funny, let's remember that or something. You know, it might be fun, or even just play it verbatim and then just listen to it to make sure there's no objectionable material or whatever. But other than that, I always thought our home game would be kind of a fun, you know, sort of a different show that we could do.
I wonder, that would be the true badge of the Superfan, listening to 6 hours of us playing cards without actually watching us playing cards.
Well, at least the first hour, that's when we all have our energy. You know, but we're a bunch of old fat guys sitting around a table, and by the second hour, we're pretty quiet and tired. But then the first hour, there are some pearls of wisdom there being exchanged, I think, that the nation could benefit from. But no, I have actually thought about that.
That's on the fourth hour before we start watching Smoking the Bandit, so.
That's right. The dubbed version on CMT.
All right, Doug. Well, appreciate the call. We'll certainly look to do a show on an upcoming cruise.
who obviously have gotten swag recently. But everybody else, call the hotline at 813-448-1120, and we'll send you something wonderful, like a t-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Anti-Up store at antiupstore.com.
I'm going to read the mailbag, Scott, because I want you to answer this one. And I'll just chime in with my funny comments, because I'm the funny one on the show. This comes from Wayne Melton. He says, the DOJ is handling players' money. They have ruled Full Tilt was a Ponzi scheme. Typically in a Ponzi scheme, they are able to show some players winning to attract investors. Eventually, everyone loses. You seem to believe that player balances would be returned. I believe they will return deposits, maybe with some interest, but will not return winnings or ending balances. So the tax issue is less complicated with returning deposits. Think about it as a Ponzi scheme and not poker winnings. They allow a few players to win to attract more players. The DOJ is not going to allow harmed players to forfeit money lost when eventually all players would have lost. Everyone gets their money back minus withdrawals, so someone who put $1,000 on the site and ran it to $1,000,000 would only get the $1,000 back. I just think the DOJ will want to treat all players harmed in a Ponzi scheme fairly and get them back to even.
Well, it's a very timely letter. Of course, it came about 2 or 3 months ago. But yeah. It's timely now.
Everything comes full circle.
With our show, we're talking about Howard Lederer. And, you know, he did have a very good explanation of the backlog, as it's being called.
And by the way, not to interrupt you, but that's exactly almost the example we always talked about when this happened.
Exactly.
Example.
So, I mean, there's lots of reasons to watch the Howard Lederer videos that we're going to talk about, but that's one point particularly here. But beside that, you know, I think there's a little bit of difference here. Yes, the Department of Justice is calling it a Ponzi scheme. I don't agree. I've already said that, but it doesn't matter what I think. It's what they think, right?
Right.
But they're not saying that the actual playing of poker on Fold Tilt was a Ponzi scheme. They're saying the overall business operation was a Ponzi scheme, and I think that's completely different. Mm-hmm. So the people that are profiting from the quote-unquote Ponzi scheme are the owners and directors of the company, not actual players on the site.
Right.
So I think that's the real difference here between what Wayne's saying and I think what we've been saying. Now, again, you know, we have no idea how this is all going to shake out. They may actually end up doing exactly like Wayne said. But I think to be pretty direct that the Ponzi scheme involved the actual poker, I think, is probably taking it a step too far.
I agree 100%. The other thing, too, is imagine the nightmare of trying to piece all of that together. How much of it is a deposit? How much of it was earned? How much of it was passed from someone else? How much of it was redeposited? You know, if I deposited 500 one day, lost 300, but then deposited 800 the next day, you know, and then I won $50 in between, there's just no way to do it. You just have to go to the balances, and those balances weren't paid for by Full Tilt Poker. I mean, the deposits were on 130,000 of these players, apparently, for the ones that where they couldn't fetch the money out of the accounts, but they wanted to keep the accounts live. You know, they essentially paid it that way because that's how they created this backlog. But no, they didn't put money on these accounts to attract other players to come to the site to make money to only eventually take that money back from them. That's not what happened. So
right.
But yeah, I mean, again, the full definition of a Ponzi scheme is not what happened here, and it's a shame that they think it's what it is. But I do feel like they just said it to make headlines more, and they would have made enough headlines anyway when they said, you know, few hundred million dollars is missing from online poker, which they deem as illegal. You know, that to me is going to get a headline anyway. You didn't need to put lipstick on a pig and put Ponzi scheme on label on it too.
We'll find out soon enough exactly how this is going to happen.
Right.
But, I'd be shocked if this is how it comes down. But Wayne, we appreciate the letter, and we are going to send you a download of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products from Smapsoft. You don't have to be a winner to enjoy this great app. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes store. And everybody else, email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and you too might be in the hopper, in the Will Hopper, for a fan segment on the show and get some great prize.
The hopper. I love those commercials. All right, call the floor for Jody this week. Comes from Nick via email. Says, I was in a 2-5 no-limit hold'em game. I pushed all in with 4-5 on a King-10-5-deuce rainbow board. I had about 260 bucks. What's that?
Solid play, by the way.
Hey.
Third pair with generous kicker.
No editorializing.
Hey, it's Nick. We can make fun of Nick.
He had about $260 and pushed into the pot as two stacks of 100 and a stack of 60. My opponent, who had three stacks and was sitting directly to my left, thought for about 3 minutes, then pushed a stack forward next to my stack. Released to count how much my short stack was, left in it there for 3 seconds with his hand hovering the stack, but off the chips, then pulled the chips back. It was obvious he was just counting, but I think this should have been a call. Of course, I didn't want it to be a call because I didn't think my five was good, so I just froze, hoping no one would say anything. Nobody did. Another brutal 3 minutes ensues. Then he mucks, showing a king. After the hand was mucked, another player asked the dealer why she didn't make it a call. She said she was looking at me, and if I had said anything, she would call the four. She even said she waited until I mucked my cards before she mucked his cards in case I wanted to call the four. I'm not sure if she was right for doing this, but I was happy with the outcome.
I'm sure you were, Nick. All right, short and sweet from Jody. In some places, the players are expected to call other players on such moves on string bets. You should buy her a birthday gift.
All right, so he's saying the players should have done that, but the dealer shouldn't have said anything.
Yeah, no, yeah, he's saying that the dealer probably should have forced this to be a call, and since she didn't, and Nick won the hand with his inferior hand, that he owes her a dinner out on the town.
Man. You know, you never know, though. I mean, a four or a five could have come on the river. There was still a
that
river.
That is true. That's true,
so
too.
Maybe he doesn't want to buy her a birthday present. I don't know.
But I would be shocked here if this was not a call in almost every room I played in.
Yeah, me too. Anytime you're moving chips forward,
motion.
And letting them go.
I mean, that's it. Just a forward motion to begin with, not even releasing the hand.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you want to count the chips, you ask the dealer to count the chips. You don't sit there and play, you know, Jenga to try to figure it out, you know. You're like, how much is it? Oh, it's 260. Okay, thanks. Let me think about it for a little longer. Not, okay, hold on. Let me finish my castle here. Push it in. Okay, let me do don't wash my hands. Nothing behind my back. No rifle. You know, come on.
No. Now, some places take it so far that if your cards are behind your chips accidentally, your chips are all in now.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the first tournament I ever played in my life at Derby Lane. They did that to me. The guy's like, are you all in? I'm like, no, why? He's like, because your cards are behind your chips. And I'm like, oh, you can't do that. Oh, okay. So, I mean, literally, you're moving chips into the pot, essentially, and then letting go of them. That's a call.
I mean, I would love to be in the room where you could, like, play choo-choo train with your chips. You know, doo-doo, coming around. Oh, no, not a call, not yet. I'll let you know. Woo, no, back. All right, hold on. Okay, no, I pulled.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. It's a joke. But, you know, what's interesting is I know Jody in the past had said that in a lot of rooms, the rule is that players call their own string bets. Now, this isn't a string bet, obviously. This is a call. But, I mean, I guess if you allow that. It's probably what this dealer is saying is, you know, hey, it's not my it's heads up here. It's not my call. If this player wants this to be a call, he'll let me know, and I'll literally call a fall over, and I got to think the floor is going to say, yeah, that's absolutely a call.
Right.
And if he doesn't want it, then fine. I mean, it is a double-edged sword here for the dealer. I mean, it's a completely different situation, I think, if there are three players in the hand. There's somebody else in the hand. But if it's heads up here, and then you... I mean, this is the whole thing that Jody said about the string bets. I mean, sometimes players don't want those bets taken back.
Yeah.
You know, they want that player to be able to raise because they got a better hand. And I think that's exactly what the dealer is doing here, right? You know, hey, I'm not going to imperil Nick's hand because the person is you know, playing Connect Four here. But as soon as he says something, obviously, we'll enforce the rule, but... Since their heads up, you know, let them do what they want to do.
Man,
I can see
crazy.
That.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's just that there's a rule is a rule is a rule.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So what's the rule in the house? If the rule in the house is you move your chips forward, take your hand off, it's a call, then that's what he did. So the dealer is supposed to enforce that rule. That's how it comes down to me. Not saying that I wanted Nick to lose $250 here or 60 or whatever it was, but rule's a rule is a rule. Just like before with the guy mucking his cards at the World Series. Hey, the rule is you mucked your hand's dead. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a rule. If we're not going to have rules, we're going to be anarchy.
It's going to be... Cats chasing dogs.
Frogs raining down from the sky.
Scott pronouncing words correctly. We can't live in a world like that.
So, I mean, what am I going to do? I'm going to go to the local poker room now and shove all in for 500 and then say, oh, just kidding? And grab
Chris
my money and run?
Waitresses.
Chris tipping waitresses and not making excuses.
No, I think you make a good point. I mean, there is consistency involved. I mean, you know, this situation like this, I can see an exception, but exceptions, you know, have the potential of causing problems down the road. So it's almost always better just to be consistent. So, all right, Nick, obviously you've been swagged up recently, but everybody else, send your questions to Jody for Call the Floor at podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and we'll send you something wonderful like a deck of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Anti-Up. Everybody else, pick up your own decks, the Anti-Up store at antiupstore.com.
You want me to continue reading? I'm doing a good job reading today.
Yeah, actually, here.
Well, your favorite part of the show always is
reading at a third grade level today. It's impressive.
Which is all I really need to do to get a job. So, in the feedback section of the show this week, Jason Kibbe writes in. He says, your last show got me thinking about taxes in regards to poker. I've only played in two tournaments and sadly bubbled them both. Of course, I hope to improve my play, but meanwhile, I expect to lose a little more than I win. That being the case, is there a point when reporting gambling losses to the IRS, realizing that you're not an accountant or an attorney, yeah, I know, we know what we're talking about, is a good idea? I know that you need to report winnings, but I also thought you could report gambling losses. I'd love for the government to subsidize my poker playing.
Yeah, Jason, we all want the government to subsidize our poker playing. Hate the burst your bubble, buddy, but you're not the first one to come up with this crazy, crazy idea. Let me smack it down here for you. In the States here, the IRS, you are, you have to report gambling winnings. You can only report gambling losses to offset those winnings.
Right.
So if you lose $10,000 during the year, you can't put that on your taxes and write it off. If you win $20,000 but also lose $10,000 somewhere else, you absolutely can report those losses and then only have to owe taxes on the $10,000 net. So you're going to have to, you know, hate to be the one to tell you this, Jason, but you're going to have to earn your own money at the table.
Yeah, because...
No shortcuts here.
And then the other thing, too, is when you're writing off the losses, I've never done it before, so I don't know what it means, but it's not exactly 100%, right? It's like a... There's like a formula or something?
I think it is 100%. No, I think it is. I mean, if you can demonstrate that you've lost $10,000 and, like I said, you have a $20,000 tournament win, then your net gambling tax liability is $10,000.
Okay.
You know, where it gets confusing, and this is why, you know, when we have Ann Margaret Johnson on the show in the coming months, she'll be able to explain this much better. You know, the tough term is verifying those losses. I mean, it's very easy to verify the wins because the casino needs to withhold and fill out forms. But, you know, much like the show we did last week, you know, if you go into a cash game in a casino and you lose money, there's no paper trail of you losing that money.
Right.
Just as there's no paper trail of you winning that money. So that's where you need to get into, you know, keeping a diary and keeping it, you know, specific enough, you know, having some proof of being in the building at the time. You know, not that I'm encouraging people to become horse racing bettors, but at least you have a ticket at that point that demonstrates that you made a $2 bet. You don't have that in poker. So that's what it comes down to, you know, keeping good records in a proper way so you can offset it. And again, it's tough to go back and do that at the end of the year. So that's probably why it's a good idea to start on January 1st and actually have that be a New Year's resolution that you keep. Not that I've ever been able to do that.
That was one of my favorite things when I used to go and watch Highline and gamble on Highline when I was younger, was to watch the guys scurrying for receipts on the ground.
Yeah.
Those are the guys you knew who just won a big trifecta, and they wanted to write off that win with, look, I prove I've lost, you know, $1,000 that day when I won $900.
Yeah, it's absolutely a way to do it. Obviously, it's not honest, but it is a way to prove losses. So, yeah. You know, no one can prove that those weren't yours. It's just, you can look at yourself in the mirror. But
see, another reason, another argument to allow credit cards to make bets.
Yeah, it's true.
You can keep records of your bets, and then you can prove they can't prove, you know, somebody wants to scramble for receipts now. Hey, your credit card's not on this receipt, so this isn't your bet. So, yeah, another way for the IRS to screw you.
Because that's what they do.
I know that's what they do. All right. So, Scott, you're hitting the road soon.
Yeah, we got a lot of housekeeping this week. Boy, yeah. A lot going on here.
Yeah, what the hell, man? Stay home once in a while, will you?
I've been home. I know what home looks like. It's the rest of the world I haven't seen.
But you'll be traveling to, where are you going, Seattle?
Seattle, yeah. I'll be in Seattle next week.
And so we're going to do some changes to our normal programming. Next week's show won't be posted until its actual Friday date. So I can just see the emails now. Is the streak over? You know, on Thursday at like 5 o'clock.
Yep.
No, the streak's not over. Well, I mean, it could end. I mean, you know, something could happen to Scott.
He could die in a
fiery plane crash or something. I don't know. But you'll want to tune in for that show, as there will be a major announcement. I believe Scott has been alluding to this announcement on Facebook or something, because I don't follow Facebook and I don't have a Facebook account, but my family does. And, you know, Scott does this post unbeknownst to me. You know, you would think you have one partner in business that I would know about these announcements. And my mom and everyone else, the phone's ringing off the hook. What's going on? There's a major announcement. Did you sell the magazine? Or are you guys going bankrupt? What's the major? First of all, we're not going to announce an announcement that we're going bankrupt, first of all. But no, that's not it. But please tune in next week. It's a pretty big deal.
Very exciting for us.
And then the following week, we're going to have our Superfan show. It's
super
actually fans! Actually is going to come to fruition, so we're pretty excited about that. And then the week after, Scott will be recapping his trip from Seattle, if your home returns home safely. Yes. So lot of stuff coming up for the show. It's a lot of different things. But yeah, next week's show will be a show. It's just going to be on Friday, that's all.
Excellent. And then remember, you can join me at Dover Downs Hotel and Casino at 7 p.m. on Friday, November 9th. That's the night before we set sail on our Annie Up Poker Cruise out of Baltimore. Good seats still available. But that night, I will be playing in the $100 buy-in, $5,000 guaranteed tournament at Dover Downs. I'll be bringing along a pair of those great Blue Shark poker optics that did not appear in Untraceable. And I'll be putting a bounty on me so you can win those great glasses. And remember, you don't have to be going on the cruise to come and enjoy yourself. Come out and meet us and some of the other listeners and fans and have a good time.
So I have to ask, do you think that we're announcing these things just a little prematurely? Not the upcoming shows, you know? Even November 9th. I mean, they got 2 months to know if they're going to have to show up. But no one's going to make, like, cross-country trips to go see you. And so,
you know, now you're tempting somebody to do that.
I am, actually. I'm trying to see if somebody... I'm trying to boost the economy.
Now it's going to find a new, you know, shipment somewhere so we can just show up there and show you up.
I'm trying to boost the economy somehow. But really, I mean, November 9th, it's what, September 21st? You got almost
you're probably right. Maybe we need to hold off on the announcements until a little closer.
I'm just thinking, you know, you're going to want to say this
every
week.
I don't want anybody to blame me
week.
For, you know, those outrageous airline tickets within 2 weeks, you know, because we didn't let them know.
Well, tune in next week when Scott reminds you yet again about the Mid-Atlantic meetup. And the week after that. And the week after that. And the week after that. But, you know, speaking of Dover Downs, who's always been very good to Annie Up, they now are hosting the inaugural Ante Up Poker League. Scott and I have tossed this idea back and forth a few times, and we think we've got a winning formula for them. Play in the 7 p.m. Wednesday night tournaments through December 12th for a chance to win an Ante Up Poker Cruise package and a personalized champion's jacket, league champion jacket, from Ante Up. More details can be found at DoverDowns.com, and ask the manager of your favorite poker room to set up an Ante Up Poker League for you to play in. I mean, it makes sense. This is kind of that... I think I had brought this up before. Remember, I had one of those ideas about having a league, you know, so I could sort of replicate that bowling league thing that I used to have when I was younger.
Yep.
It's the same kind of thing. You know, you're going to play poker. You're playing for points as well as the normal prize pool that you'd be playing for. But at the end of it, too, if you win, you get a jacket, something proud to be, you know, proud of that you can wear. And then also you get to go on a cruise with your spouse or your friend or whatever. Just for playing in this league, and that you would have probably gone and, you know, played poker that night anyway. And this, there's no requirement for you to go every week, but there is going to be this event every week on Wednesday, and you should go because you want to get as many points as possible. It's a cool league. I think it's a great idea.
It's actually even better in a bowling league because you don't have to wear a funny shirt that says Spike on it. Come as you are.
I love the general public's cliches of bowling. And I suppose we all have to be overweight and smoke cigars and eat nachos tableside.
I'm just going to say, back when I was a sports editor, there was a Tums Open
Tums Classic, and I used to cover it.
For the PBA, there was never that for tennis. So.
It was in Connecticut. I used to cover the Tums Classic every year. I was there every year. Bradley Bowl, baby. That's true. That is true. But you know what? There are plenty of oddly named events in all of the tours of life, so don't be busting on that because there's Tums Classic and Bowl.
I'm just saying it fits the cliche that you are telling me that does not exist. So, all right, we're also looking for some new ambassadors in Canada. We're going to be starting to push north, eh? So apply at antiupmagazine.com/ambassadors, and even if you're in the United States somewhere, go ahead and fill out one there. You never know when we have an opening, and we'd love to have you. And then, of course, we mentioned the cruises. Remember, we got five more coming up. Baltimore, Port Canaveral, Miami, New York City, and Tampa. Get all the details at andyupcruises.com. Watch our new promotional video. And we also have more upcoming giveaways at both Dover Downs Hotel and Casino and just announced Derby Lane in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Yeah, there's a little subtle announcement there. We have a new website, andyupcruises.com.
Well, we kind of announced it last week, so it's a little...
Yeah, I know, but you know, we never really said anything last week either. We just said andyupcruises.com, but... It's kind of cool.
Yeah, we're just, you know, trying to get the... We got that tiny URL-itis.
Yeah.
So, trying to shrink everything down.
Pretty soon
it's going to be AUC.com.
It's going to be A.com.
A.com.
Go to A.com. I'm sure that exists already. Somebody has A.com somewhere.
Oh, I'm sure it's one of those domain parking spots. Hey, this domain is available. Inquire for a price. And it's going to be like $27
million. $600,000, yeah. I want to do my Bob McKenzie impression when you were talking about Canada, but you didn't let me, so I'm just going to have to move on to the Indy Up News Desk.
It's probably best that only one of us makes fun of Canada. You know, totally unrelated, but I was somewhere the other day talking about Canada, and somebody asked me if I knew the words to O Canada.
Somebody asked you that?
Yes.
Why?
You know what? It was at the post office, because I was mailing some magazines up to one of the rooms in Canada. And the clerk is like, hey, Canada, do you know the words to O Canada? And I'm like, you know what? I do. Give him a link to the PokerCast.
Do you know the ideal body weight of Anne Murray, a beloved Canadian songstress? What the hell kind of question is this? This is a random question this guy asked you. Hey, Scott, you know the lyrics of Stairway to Heaven? No. Why'd you ask me that? Well, there's stairs that come up to the post office, and I thought maybe...
You know, some people are awkward in their conversations. They're just trying... I mean, it's better than, hey, some weather we're having today. When I look outside, it's the same weather we've had for the last 4 months.
That reminds me of, what was it, Good Will Hunting, when Matt Damon walks up to the girl, and she's like, you know... What's going on, you know, whatever? And he's like, hey, you want to go get some caramels? And she's like, what? And he's like, caramels. And she's like, what do you mean? And he's like, well, it's just as arbitrary as a cup of coffee, you know? And it's the same thing. It's like some random, hey, you want to go get some cotton candy? What? Well, it's better than coffee, right? I mean, who wants to get coffee in these days? You get some cotton candy. I mean, it's just totally random things. People are weird, man. Our postmaster general, he's weird. All right, let's move on to our Andy Up News Desk here and see what's going on.
A summary text of the federal online bill that Senators Harry Reid and John Kyle have been working on has been released. Among the interesting things included are the states will have to opt in to be included. There will be a 15-month blackout period for licensing, and any money wagered on unlicensed sites would be subject to forfeiture.
I've read this thing. And
good.
Do you feel like poker stars get screwed in this or no?
Oh, they absolutely do. But we knew that was going to happen. I mean, obviously the people pushing this are the incumbent industries here, and they're the ones that that are going to be the first out of the gate. Now, beyond that, what was interesting, obviously, this 15-month blackout. No one's excited about it because we have no idea when or if this bill is ever going to be passed.
Right.
But then after it is, then you got 15 months you got to wait before it actually all starts. But part of it was meant to allow competitive balance, so you don't have people right out of the gate being able to flip the switch and not let other people get into the marketplace. So in that sense, I can get it, and that's kind of fair. Now, obviously, they have frozen out sites that service the country after UIGA for, 2 years after the 15-month blackout, something like that. Maybe 5 years. Period.
It might have been five, because I remember looking at it and going, oh my God.
Yeah. But, I'm not a big fan of the UIGA, don't get me wrong, but, if this is kind of the game you play now, and if you flaunt the law, which lawmakers think that Poker Stars did, you got to pay a price. I mean, it could be worse. They could say, you know, hey, you're never going to be allowed back in. So, yeah. But, you know, the site we're going to, I mean, this online, if this bill is passed, is still vastly different than anything we experienced before. So I don't know necessarily how terrible of a loss it is for Poker Stars to come in 5 years afterwards. You know, I mean, the big thing is the opting in. I mean, that's going to be a nightmare. Every legislature is going to have to vote on whether they should be part of this. So the whole player liquidity argument that we're all fighting about on this intrastate model right now is not going to be resolved by this. You know, once this bill is passed, it doesn't mean anybody's going to be able to play until their state legislature approves. And then, you know, tribal lands aren't going to be able to opt in either if the state doesn't opt in that they're located in. So, you know, it's going to be very interesting. Of course, you got 15-month blackout periods. You got plenty of time for this stuff to get approved at the states. But, yeah, it's certainly not the bill that I think most poker players were hoping for.
I love how you say 15 months is plenty of time for state legislature. I mean, look how long these things take. I would say 60 months.
Well, it depends on the state. I mean, what we've seen, I mean, certainly in Congress it takes forever to get anything done, but we've seen states, I mean, look at Maryland. I mean, they called a special session in August, and within 14 days had a new bill allowing poker or table games to be allowed in their casinos.
Yeah.
I mean, it happened that quickly. So it can happen, you know, if in the right culture, particular climate. But in some states, it's just going to linger on forever because, I mean, now the problem is now you need to go back to the state legislatures and prove to people that they should opt in to this thing. And that's a much harder sell, I think, than selling people an opting out of something.
Yeah.
Particularly when we're talking about gaming.
Because if it's important to the state, then they would opt out. If it's, you know what I mean? It should, I think that everybody should be automatically in. They should have to opt out, not opt in. Opt in requires a lot more problems to be solved.
Yeah, from a poker player standpoint, obviously. Yeah. But from a legislator standpoint, I mean, you're forcing, and now you got the federal, this is the whole state's rate argument that gets people upset. Now you're forcing the state legislature to actually take up this issue and spend time debating it for no reason.
Yep.
Exactly. Making it opt in, then they can decide whether it's worth their time to debate it. So it sucks for us, but it actually makes, I think it's more fair for the states.
All right, the Poker Players Alliance has released its congressional voting guide for the 2012 elections, and only 57 of the 535 members of the U.S. Congress and Senate earned failing grades, down from 194 2 years ago. However, there are also fewer grades of A's and B's this year.
Yeah, got that whole bell curve working now.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, it's interesting. They talked a little bit about that. There's been a change in the mindset of a lot of lawmakers, where before they were adamant against any kind of gaming. Now they're not adamant. Doesn't mean they're for it, but they're just not as adamant. So their grades improve. And then they said they wanted to have some higher criteria for the A's and B's, so you really knew who the true fans were, not just people that, you know, said they support it, but people are actively pushing for it.
So this has got to be much easier. It's got to be some of the campaigning that we're doing on our part of poker players, making these people understand that poker is skill and it's a competition between people, not against the house. That's making some of these people understand, hey, this is not unlike golf where people are competing against each other, and perhaps that's why they're softening their stance, because they're realizing that poker isn't necessarily gambling or gaming. It's just poker, you know.
Yeah, I think that's some part of it. I think the other part of it is that the economy is just forcing more people to look at gaming in general, not just poker.
Yeah,
and it's becoming something where, you know, hey, you know, our state needs money, and this is something that's acceptable elsewhere. So why is it? Maybe it's not something that I should be as opposed to as I have been. I think that's probably more of it. Yeah. But you're probably right. I mean, obviously the PPA has done a good job of raising awareness, and you know, other things out there have been. So, I mean, all kind of working together, but, you know, it's progress.
Closer and closer.
And finally, Nelson Burtnick, who is responsible for payment processing for Full Tilt Poker. Have you ever heard of Full Tilt Poker, Chris?
Mm,
maybe someday we should do a show on it.
Not before today.
All right. Well, Nelson Burdick, who was responsible for payment processing for Full Tilt Poker, has pleaded guilty for his role in mischaracterizing transactions between the online site and U.S. banks. Burdick faces up to 15 years in prison.
We should note that this obviously happened after the letter interview.
Right? Exactly, yes.
Otherwise, that probably would have been brought up somehow, probably within the interview. Although we still have three interviews
maybe
left or whatever to listen to, but two or whatever. Interesting stuff. Faces 15 years in prison. You know, he actually admits to it that he did it himself. That's crazy that this stuff is all just starting to come down now.
You're certainly looking for a leniency sentencing here.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're combative saying, I didn't do this, and you're convicted that it's harder to get the judge to give you 5.
Yeah. Man. Brutal. Okay, well, we get to complete an O'Malley's move today. Always exciting when we can do that and hear how stupid we looked. So here we go. Here's part one.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are seated at a $1, $2, no-limit hold'em home game. We are somewhat short-handed, with 7 seated at the table. We are in the small blind with $250. It's fairly early in the night, but this is our regular home game, so we know most of these players and their tendencies. Under the gun and plus one both fold. The MP folds, and the cutoff makes it $7 to go. A standard raise for this table. The button folds, and we see the ace of spades, 7 of clubs. Since it's early in the night, everyone has almost identical stacks. Our opponent sits with about $10 more than us. She's a solid player, so this raise from the cutoff could be either a steal attempt or a solid hand. But we want to set the tone for the evening that we won't be pushed around on our small blind. We call, and the big blind folds. The pot is $16, and the flop comes the Queen of Hearts, 4 of Hearts, Deuce of Hearts. A swing and a miss big time. But it is a suited flop, which often scares people. We're going to take an aggressive line on this pot and try to strong-arm our opponent out. She's solid enough to realize we could have hit this. And if she has something like jacks or king-queen, she might fold to a bet. We make it $10 to go, but she calls. We narrow her range down and factor in some tells. She seems pretty confident. This could very well be aces, kings, or ace-king with a heart. She also might have queens. Some other hands could be jacks with a heart, or king-queen with the king of hearts. But we don't see her playing much weaker hands than these for a raise pre-flop and then a call on such a wet board. The pot is now $36, and the turn is the queen of diamonds. This is an interesting card. Could we have represented ace-queen? Most players at this table know we usually don't 3-bet ace-queen pre-flop, so it's possible. We set out on a plan for this hand, and we're not going to stray from it. In this situation, the cards are irrelevant. We make a $20 bet, and just as we suspected, she goes into the tank. She appears to be calculating the pot odds, and maybe even the implied odds. While she's doing this, we narrow her range. There's a good chance we can eliminate queens, jacks, and king-queen with the king of hearts. We're also pretty sure she's got us on ace-queen, unless she's Hollywooding, which she doesn't do often. She begrudgingly calls, and the river is the deuce of clubs, putting 2 pair on the board. The pot is $76. So, do we have another round in the chamber?
Can I say this, Chris?
I don't know, can you?
You're certainly, I would think, we both agree, more macho than I am, right? Got a little more of a sensitive side. You got the, you know, Italian genes working, right?
Hey, don't be offending my people.
I'm not offending your people. I'm just saying they got
unless
a little
you're,
more
unless you're gusto referring...
in the tank than my Norwegian, whatever, Nordic people that I my family came from.
Well, I mean, if you're referring to my Roberto Cavalli designer jeans that I wear to special restaurants, that's one thing. But if you're talking about my heritage, you better watch it, buddy. I can make a few phone calls. Get that insurance money coming my way.
All right, here's the thing. I just don't, maybe somebody could explain to me, but I just don't understand why we need to be so macho defending our small blinds. You know, it's the worst position at the table.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You only have half a bet in, not the full bet like you do in the big blind. You know, I'm going to let people abuse me all night there because the risk just doesn't equal the reward. And as we may be, that's exactly what we might be reminded of here. You know, the big blind is a little bit different. I understand defending that, even though I'm not crazy in defending that all the time. But the small blind, completely different story, I think. So, you know, when O'Malley's saying, hey, I'm not going to be pushed around, I'm going to take a stand here. Okay. Not me. But, you know, here's the thing. As play, that's the way we have to do this, right? We have to fire the third round here.
Sure.
We've laid out an entirely believable story that we have a queen in our hand. Our opponent is leading us to believe he was on a draw, which totally missed, or a made hand, which now has probably got counterfeited if he believes we have a queen. So I'm going to say, hey, you wanted to be macho from the small blind, didn't you?
Is that an Italian accent? Because that was horrible.
I'm working on it. Yeah, it's first time. I had to adapt it for my dad's dove impression. We're going to be macho, man up!
Oh my god, that was so bad. Well, my first reaction was, wow, does this player already have the flush and is just calling us, you know, just like walking the dog or whatever, or letting the dog walk us or whatever the hell you want to call it? If that's the case, we have to bet. Because we know, by the story we've told, he must know we filled up here. And you can't just let go now and hope your kicker is good. This guy was calling the whole way with no, you know, I mean, at the end, if he was calling for a fourth heart, you know, then you have to bet, hoping that he'll just muck and that he didn't make some other pair that goes with the queens, you know, like he had a king in his hand or something. So, with the king of hearts. So, really, I mean, you have to bet. You have to bet, and I just hope that O'Malley is convincing with his betting and his acting. All right, well, we'll hear part two now, and we'll be back with our final thought.
Hello again. This is a beautiful card for our hand. We've basically ruled out her having a queen. She would have raised the turn with a queen. Additionally, we're pretty sure she has us on ace-queen. We're going to fire one more round. We make it $50 to go and hear a beautiful sound. A groan. Followed by a muttered, I should have raised you on the flop. She once again goes into the tank before folding the ace of hearts, king of hearts, face up. Wow, we dodged a bullet there. The river was the absolute perfect card for our hand, or at least for how we played the hand. We don't show the bluff since this is a friendly home game, but our main saving grace in this one is the way our opponent played it. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying sometimes it's best to forget what your cards are and play your opponent and the board. I hope to see you on the felt.
Now, I don't do this often, but I think O'Malley doesn't give himself enough credit here. Now, I shouldn't say that. I mean, he does a great job with this segment, but he really played this very well. I mean, obviously, I mean, his opponent really should have raised on the turn, but I don't know of a lot of players that probably would. You know, you got this person hanging himself. Let him keep firing, you know.
Right.
Let him make that third bullet on the end, or if not, you're going to raise on the river anyhow. And then you just got unlucky. But I really think, you know, again, O'Malley was the real master in this hand. You know, if you forget the whole defending a small blind circus.
And I wasn't surprised to learn that the guy had the flush already. That was kind of what I alluded to when I first reacted to this. And then I wasn't surprised that he folded, because really, the flush now can only beat a bluff.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, so I think it's a good lay down, even if it was the best hand. I mean, it really, the way O'Malley sold it, it's hard for this guy to drill down to the bedrock of his betting and his hand and to think, oh, he's been bluffing the whole way. I mean, unless the guy really thought all he had was aces, you know what I mean, or something like that. To me, I think everything. I wasn't really that surprised by any of this. I was sort of nervous for O'Malley because the guy could have easily just had ace queen, and been, yeah, you know, or just a queen in his hand, and then being cautious with the queens, and then fills up himself. you know what I mean, on the turn, or not fills up, but triples up on a turn, and then fills up on the end. But really, it was pretty ballsy, and did what he had to do, and it worked out. He played the person, and he played the scenario the way he was supposed to. It's just, yeah, it's pretty scary to get that involved in the small blind when you're acting first throughout the hand.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a textbook example of how you turn position around on you and make it an advantage rather than a disadvantage. Now, the problem, of course, is there's no way to do that without heavily committing yourself to the hand, as he did here. And, you know, he ended up having to be lucky on the river. You don't always have to be lucky on the river there. I mean, it could be different, but, you know, this is a way of really putting doubt in somebody's position. I mean, position is everything in the game, and he totally took it away from his opponent here.
Yeah, yeah, very exciting. I like I said, throughout the hand, I was just thinking, oh my God, we're getting deeper and deeper into this, and we're going to have to keep firing, and if we don't win, we're going to be, you know.
And that's almost all the problem with small blind, isn't it? You keep firing, and next thing you know, like, oh man, where'd my stack go? Well, that's because you decided to be macho with your small blind. All right, this week our web partner, PokerNews.com, has started releasing a series of videos edited from an exclusive 7-hour sit-down interview with Howard Letter, one of the founders of Embattled Full Tilt Poker, who has been more or less silent on the company's collapse since Black Friday. Letter told Poker News he wanted to start explaining what he knew and when he knew it, now that the sale of the site had been completed and that players will soon be reimbursed. Poker News insisted Letter would answer any question, and Poker News decided after the interview that it would be better to show edited video clips than a traditional news story, so much of Letter were said would be unvarnished. 5 videos, each about 30 minutes long, have been released so far, with at least one, maybe more, to come. And we've caught up on the first 5, and Chris, I gotta say, this is fascinating stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I wonder if I'm gonna be pulling these words right out of your mouth, but did you get this sort of feeling that it was just like the Frost Nixon interviews? I mean, isn't that, it was so much, I kept thinking that throughout these interviews, not that they were that important to, you know, the world, obviously, but they're that important to poker players, I would think, as opposed to how important the Nixon interview was to the American public and the world, really. But yeah. I just felt like there was sort of this, okay, we're going to arrange for a room at the Palazzo. You know, I could just see Parvis and all of his news editors getting together before this and coming up with this massive amount of information and questions and tactics of when you're going to ask these questions, how you're going to make the flow go. And then there is this letterer camp with his lawyer and everything else getting together and talking about what he's going to be able to reveal, what he's going to have to say is speculation, what he's going to have to say, I don't remember. You know, and that kind of thing. I just felt like, oh my God, this is like, you know, Frost Nixon 2.0, but for the poker people.
Yeah, I didn't really shoot that high, but that's a very good analogy. I mean, I was thinking more of kind of a 60 Minutes kind of thing, and you know, obviously for people that aren't poker players, this is meaningless. But for those of us that are poker players and interested, I mean, this was something that I never thought we would see. I would never thought that we would see him sit down for 7 hours, and you know, obviously we've only seen 2.5 hours of it. And I mean, it was just extraordinary to me. And I think, I really do think Poker News really understood how important this was, right, and handled it well. You know, a couple times I found myself saying, come on, Matt, get your question out.
Yeah, me too. I did the same thing.
But other than that, I mean, I thought they did really well. They asked good questions. They laid it out well. The decision to run the videos I thought was great. I mean, it's not riveting TV, there's no explosions going on or anything like that, you know, the MTV generation looks for. But actually sit there and watch Howard answer this, I thought was very powerful. And certainly not worried about stuff being left out. I mean, obviously it's edited, so you're not seeing everything, but I'm sure they just kind of, I shouldn't say I'm sure, my impression is they probably just edited out some stuff that wasn't very fascinating. I really didn't move the ball much.
But, right, yeah. I'm sure they wouldn't have taken it out of context, because then all of a sudden, what was the point of doing this interview if you weren't going to entrust the interviewee, you know, and the interviewer? So, I mean, I think that, yeah, the editing was merely for just tightening things up. And like you said, too, about Parvis getting the question out, I just felt, and I know it wasn't a slight on him, I just felt like Howard would interrupt him if he took too long to ask the question, and I know what question he wants to ask. You know what I mean? That I was feeling the same way. I'm like, come on, get it out. You know.
Yeah.
There were some occasions where I was like, how could you not ask this part now? But I can't say what that is because I haven't seen the whole interview yet. So maybe he still will. So, but there were parts where I'm like, oh, you got to follow up with this, and that wasn't going to happen. But overall, you know, I first started watching it, and I'm like, I felt uncomfortable watching Howard Lederer at first. I really did. I felt like, I'm like I said, we don't know either way what's going on until we hear what he says. But at the same time, I was kind of like, God, I feel like this guy shouldn't be talking. You know, I like his lawyers, I can't believe his lawyers are saying, yeah, it's okay to talk now or to say all this stuff with all this stuff still hanging over his head. It just felt weird. It felt weird that he was talking. And that's something to remember, too, as we talk about these and as you watch them. He's not under oath. Not saying that he's lying at all. I'm not saying that at all. But just remember that, that what he's saying, if you're choosing to believe it or not believe it, he's not under oath. So what he's saying that he can't remember or what he's saying, what happened, we don't know all sides. You know, when we talk about Phil Gordon later and stuff or Ray Bittar, you know, they could now chime in and say none of that happened. And then who do you believe? So it's compelling stuff. And the other thing, too, you have to remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it doesn't matter what he says if you believe that Howard Lederer, as one of the board members and owner of this billion-dollar company, essentially, if you believe that he should have been way more hands-on and should have known about every single little thing that happened, if you believe that, then no matter what he says isn't going to matter anyway.
Exactly. That's a very good point. Absolutely. And I think there's a lot of people that do say that or do believe that.
Right.
And we'll get into some of the business part of this later where we can talk about that. But you're right. You know, there are people out there like me that I think were a little bit more rational about this whole thing and kind of wanted to know who knew what and when. And there certainly are other people out there that just don't care. I mean, I posted something on our Facebook page last night, and the first comment was, what's there to talk about?
Yeah.
And I'm like, there's a lot. This is a fascinating interview. Well, until these guys are found guilty, I don't really care. So, I mean, there are, and that's certainly not an isolated comment. I'm sure there's lots of people that say the same thing. You know what? I don't want to hear anything else. Give me my money back, put these guys in jail, and then I'll be happy. And I think that's unfortunate because I think there's a lot for us to learn in this. And, you know, I'm not falling into the some kind of Jim Jones drink the Kool-Aid spell and Howard Lederer here. But, you know, I will be upfront here that, as our listeners know, I've always been a little bit more rational about this case than I think some other people have been. Probably been accused of being a Howard Lederer apologist. And I'm sure my comments throughout the rest of today's show are going to make people think that I am that when I don't really believe I am, but I thought he handled himself well, you know. And here's the thing, you know, you're right. There wasn't any reason for him to do this.
Right.
I mean, there was a reason for him to do it because players deserve to know what happened. But for him personally to be the one to come out and do this, that there's absolutely no reason for him to do it. And the fact that he did it, I think, speaks that, you know, he really at this point. This was the time. He's probably been wanting to do this for a long time. That's what I've been hearing through other people. And this just was the appropriate time now that the company's been sold, and fairly soon people will start getting their money back, hopefully.
Right. As you listen to his comments, you can understand that if he's telling the truth, that he really wanted to do everything possible to make sure that the players got paid back. And what that also meant was to not do things that would hinder their opportunity to get paid back. And one of those things, I'm sure, was if he came out and said everything he knew and everything that was going on prematurely, that he would have dissuaded any potential investors. Because there's some serious crap going on here later on that you'll find out about when we talk about it. That, you know, if those things had come to light before they can quell them or before they could, you know, make sense of it or whatever, that might have stopped, you know, PokerStars from buying the assets or whatever. So when you hear him, he's trying to make you understand that everything that he did was to stop the bleeding and to get the players paid back. Now, if you choose not to believe it, that's your choice, but everything that he says, it seems consistent with that. And that as well means why he didn't come out until now, because now the deal is done, and now he can say all the things that everyone's asking him to reveal. So,
yeah, I mean, so I got a couple questions here before we got a lot to talk about this, but what's your thought? I mean, I thought that I certainly didn't see him get caught in anything. You know, there's no follow-up questions where he said, you caught me there. And I think that was pretty telling. And then the other thing, too, is I'm curious what you think. I mean, there were a lot of I don't remembers in this, which, we're talking really 8 years of, company business.
Right.
But were you surprised by that? Were you turned off by it? Or were you not surprised by it?
Well, I have to say that it always bothers me when we're watching gripping television or some movie and they say something to the effect of, oh, I remember when I picked you up for our first date, in high school, you were wearing a green dress with... And there's no way you remember all that stuff. You just don't. It just makes for funny television or good, details. We talk about the book that I wrote and how, when you're trying to make the person remember where they were on that day or whatever. Well, if something significant happens to you on that day, your mind, the long-term memory forces you to remember it because it's significant. It's out of the norm. But for the casual, everyday, run-of-the-mill, usual business stuff, you're not going to remember it. So a lot of times when Parvis is saying, do you remember this email from 2005 when it's 2012 and he's had so much else go on in his life, for him to say, I really don't remember, I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday because it's mundane and it doesn't mean anything. So really, a random email from 2005, even if it is about, which you'll find out if you watch the videos, there was an email saying, I want to make sure my money is segregated, and then he ultimately gets to that and stuff. But stuff like that where there's just like a random email 7 years ago, I can see why he wouldn't remember those things. I don't know if he's using it as a defense, but really, I mean, there. If you said to me, Scott, hey, Chris, you remember the email I sent you from 2008 when we first launched the magazine about how we want to treat certain letters? No. I don't remember that. There's no way I'm going to remember that.
Well, I was reminded of this even before the video. I mean, obviously, archive all of our emails that we've ever had, and it's easily searchable. And I was looking for something the other day, and I stumbled on an email that exchange that we had a couple years ago, and I really did not remember. I mean, it wasn't anything earth-shattering, but I'm like, wow, I totally forgot that we had that whole conversation. So. When I'm watching him throughout saying, I don't remember, I understand that. And to his credit, I would say that there weren't big blocks of time that he didn't remember. I mean, he remembered the essence of what was being asked. He just couldn't confirm that it was the specific email or the specific day or the specific time. And I'm willing to give anybody a pass on that as long as they're not trying to hide the overall what was going on. And I didn't get the sense that he was trying to hide really anything from me on this time.
I mean,
I was under spell.
Give you an idea, when I wrote that book, I spent, years on that. And when I reviewed it recently to update it and get it loaded up for the publishing thing, I read it over again to edit it to make sure there's no mistakes. And as I'm reading, I'm like, wow, I don't even remember this. This is the book I wrote and spent hours and hours and hours and hours poring over. So, I don't fault anybody. And he's got to be around 50-something now. So, I mean, your mind, they say, tends to deteriorate as you're getting older. And your memory is like the first thing that, other than vision, really, that deteriorates. So to say you don't remember mundane things or even things that were sent to Ray Bitar and you may have gotten them secondhand or something. I'm not making an excuse for him, but I wasn't surprised by him saying that. The other thing, too, is we don't know if he was privy to these questions that Parvis was going to ask him so he could prepare answers. We don't know that. I don't know. Was it in there that said that we did not give him questions?
I got the impression that from some of the lead up story that Howard did do a lot of prep. I don't know if he had the questions, but I think he obviously, as he mentioned during the video, reread the Alderney report in the last week before this. Tried to bone up on as much as he could so he could give as good of answers as he could. I don't know whether I don't think they gave him the actual questions, but they might have gave him topics. But I don't think anything that he was asked was. I don't think he would have been surprised by anything that he was asked.
Right.
In the interview. And, I really did think he was just trying to get as much information out to people. I never got the sense that he was trying to say, hey, don't blame me. I think he was just. Here's what happened, and you guys have a right to know it, and, if you don't like me still, that's fine. If you like me better now, that's fine. But I didn't see this as a try to repair his reputation interview, where very easily could have been.
Right. No, I mean, and I agree. I think that his camp had to have been preparing him for this. It wasn't like they just cornered him at the Palazzo and said, hey, come out to my room, we're going to talk to you. It was well planned out, and they told him, we need to ask any question, you have to answer every question we ask. So then he had to say, okay, well, tell me everything you're going to want to talk about as far as bullet points, and then I will recall as much as I can and prepare myself for it so I can give you the full answer. So not unlike the Frost-Nixon interviews where they told him everything they were going to ask in what order, and of course they mixed it up on him and threw him off and tried to get him to, to balk, but Nixon I'm talking about, not Lederer.
Right.
So, there. One of the things that he was very adamant about was defending Chris Ferguson.
Yeah.
At least from the early point of the company, when he's talking, there's one part in there where he's talking about, the company's doing well, and they're making lots of money, but they haven't paid anybody anything yet. They've not paid a dime to each other as far as disbursements or salaries or whatever it was. And he said everyone in that room talked about it and considered it and wanted to get some disbursements for their investment because they all were part of that initial $2 million or whatever it was that they raised capital to start this venture. And there was one person in the room who said, you cannot take any money from this company. We need to make it stronger. We need to keep going, blah, blah, blah. And it was Ferguson who did that.
Yeah.
And then he talks about how he's the least greedy person that he knows, that he is not extravagant at all. The most expensive thing that he'd ever buy for himself would be like a new Stetson hat or whatever it was that he wears for his getup and stuff. And that he lived in some modest 1,500 square foot house in Nevada, and that he didn't, so to say that is fine. He's trying to defend Chris because he's coming under this heat for the money that he had in Swiss accounts and everything or whatever, I'm assuming. But it was interesting to see him defend Chris on more than one occasion throughout this whole thing without even being asked to.
Yeah, yeah. And I think what was more interesting for me, and maybe I missed this in all the full tilt lead up, but was the fact that Ray Bittar was Chris Ferguson's guy.
Yeah.
They knew each other before this. When they started the company, Howard said, Chris said, hey, I know this guy Ray, let's bring him in. So that, to me, that's why I really want to hear from Chris now. I mean, I want to hear a parallel timeline from Chris, so it's just not Howard we're hearing from.
Right.
But I think it's impossible after listening to this interview to not give credence to what many of us said before, that our hunch was that what happened here was a CEO that got in over his head, caused a problem, tried hard to solve it, and at least I got the impression probably did figure out a way to solve it, and then the government just ran the clock out on him. And I want to hear more about that, about this relationship that Chris and Ray had beforehand. And I'm curious what you think too, but I really didn't get the sense through this entire interview that Howard ever specifically threw Ray Bittar under the bus here, but clearly by the narrative and what he was explaining, what he knew and went. It's very hard for anybody to come out of this without thinking that this was Ray's job. Ray was the one involved in what was going on. Obviously, we can still blame the board members and the other members for not having oversight over him, but it certainly seemed that that this is what happened. They mentioned, you know, how they were a number of the members didn't like Ray.
Right.
I mean, I just like, I could take him or leave him, but really did not like him. So, I mean, the guy had some likability problems, it sounds like. The other thing that I think is consistent with this, and not just my opinion, but right now, of these folks, the only person facing criminal charges of the board is Ray Bitar.
Right.
Everybody else is facing civil because, you know, they, according to the government, benefited from this fraud. But he's the only one right now facing criminal charges. And I got to think, and I could be wrong, I got to think that if the government had a reason to pin criminal charges on Howard or Chris or Rafe or anybody else, that they would. I mean, why wouldn't they?
Yeah. And why would they? Why now, so long later? You know, it obviously would have happened already, I think.
I mean, that doesn't make sense to me. Why wouldn't they? I mean, the whole from the beginning of this Black Friday, you know, pre-Bahara was like a pit bull with blood streaming down his face, right?
Mm.
Take no prisoners on this. So, you know, why let these guys, I don't want to say off scot-free because obviously he's trying to seize $40-some million from them, but why not throw them into the criminal part of the indictment? There's got to be some reason in all their investigation that what's happened from a legal standpoint is happening. And to that extent, I think it gives what Howard has said in this interview.
Yeah, and I did think that it was interesting that they wanted to try to get a majority to get rid of Bitar. When I say they, I mean the people who didn't like him. John Jawanda was one of them, they said. But the board was only 5 members, and when you have Howard, Chris, and Bitar as 3 of them, you're not going to get a majority, right? Is that?
Well, that's the board, but I mean, again, this is an LLC, so it was a member vote.
Member vote, yeah. But they still didn't have enough members to do it either.
Well, they could have, yeah. I mean, that was Howard's point. Again, this is where this whole conversation is going to get better the more we hear from other people, and I think we're probably going to start to hear from some of these other members now that Howard has, and try to get their views, and then we have really a bigger canvas to really focus our own personal thoughts on. And I do think there's going to be some revisionist history. There probably was some already with Howard in this interview. I don't think much, but there probably was some, and there's probably going to be some with the members too about, you know, hey, I really did want to get rid of them when they probably didn't, but it's just popular to say that now. So I don't know, you know, but clearly, you know, you get the impression that at the very least, Ray was over his head. And we'll talk about that more in the business part because I think there's some interesting stuff there. But the last video, number 5, almost all about Phil Ivey.
Yeah.
And this lawsuit. And I found this, of all the stuff that was fascinating, this was truly fascinating this morning watching this. You know, I want to know, after hearing Howard's point of view, obviously we haven't heard from Phil, is Phil Ivey selfish for this lawsuit or within his rights?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to bring up before we even had was the fact that when we mentioned this lawsuit, we talked about that it was like the money that was in his account that it was owed to him,
right?
And that he was using that as players weren't getting paid, I'm not getting paid, you know, we deserve our money or something. But what it actually ended up being was he wanted to sell his shares of the company and get his money that he's owed for the company, not his bank, not his bankroll.
Well, getting counted to Howard. I mean, I'm really interested to go back and read the actual lawsuit to find out. But
and
yeah,
he does
I
say mean, it's right there in the lawsuit. He wants $150 million, and he says obviously the company couldn't pay him $150 million. And then he said, "What's he going to do with $150 million?" Nowhere in the lawsuit is he saying he's suing us for the players and he's giving the players the money. That's not in the lawsuit. It's Phil Ivey wants $150 million, and if he's telling the truth and it's all true, and you can look at the lawsuit somehow, I guess if you FOI or whatever.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure, yeah.
You would know. So here it is. Everyone's thinking Phil Ivey's a hero because he's sitting out the World Series and as a protest, and he's suing Full Tilt to get the money to him and the players. Was that the case, or was it Phil Ivey just looking out for Phil Ivey now? I mean, is he within his rights? Sure, he's within his rights. He's a company shareholder or member or whatever at this point, and he wants to get out, and he wants to sue the company because he's owed that money or something. I guess he's willing.
Well,
his
rights. But here's what Howard laid out. I'm just laying what Howard. I mean, I'm not opining on it here. But what Howard was saying is that, you know, Phil Ivey wanted out of his Full Tilt contract, and he wanted to go have the option to represent other sites. But how they set up the company was the celebrity endorsers that were investors at the beginning were paid handsomely for that, and part of being paid handsomely for that was the understanding that you were a Full Tilter for life, and so there is no more Full Tilt. And so then he said, you know, once after Black Friday and all this happens, all of a sudden now Phil brings this back up and tries to sue the company when he knows there's no money to get. And what Howard is saying is the lawsuit is harming the ability of the company to sell itself and pay back the players, or really pay back the members anything at that point. And you know, from the outside now hearing that, I can totally see what Howard is saying. Now obviously I don't know the internal debate going on with Phil Ivey over the last couple of years at the company, but it's a very different picture than I think that we had, as you mentioned, when this happened during the World Series, that here's a guy trying to get the money back and make this company pay. And you know, obviously Howard had a very different view of it, very strongly. I mean he did not get very upset in these interviews at all, but that was the one time I think you could see him really, really upset.
Right, because he felt that it would totally end any chance of them selling the assets to actually pay the players back. So what it looked like was Phil Ivey was trying to do this to get the players paid back, and then what Howard was saying was what he would do would actually keep them from getting paid back. And he also alludes to the Binion deal. You know, when we were in Vegas and we'd heard about this Binion's wants to buy Full Tilt rumor, he actually, you know, says that was the case, that Binion wanted to buy for 40% of the price, and that the reason Binion didn't walk away from the deal but totally just got, you know, unenamored with it was because of Ivey and Ivy's suit. And that was what made him say, you know what, there's no way I can put an offer on the table now for this, because the company, if Ivy's suing us and whatever, then the face of Full Tilt is suing Full Tilt. How could there be any value to this company now? And that was one of the things that, you know, he alluded to, that they lost the Binion's deal because of it, and they would have lost other deals too had, you know, this thing come to fruition or whatever. So it's interesting, you know, everyone painted Ivy as a hero when actually he could have been the one that kept everybody from making money if this is all true.
Yeah, and I think at the very end of the last part five, too, you start to see, at least in Howard's point of view, the scrambling for life rafts from the folks. I mean, obviously, the board meeting or member meetings now are being populated by personal attorneys, and it's very tough to get stuff going. And then we have this Phil Gordon's play to take over the board. They actually succeeded, and then ended up collapsing. You know, where they got, you know, more than 50% of the members to agree, and Phil, the two Phils and Andy Block were going to take over from the board until they realized that it ended up not being a good idea, which is interesting that, you know, the members decide to elevate someone who just sued the company as a board. Now, obviously, I mean, there's some times that would make sense, I guess. But you know, one of the interesting things is Howard was saying that the member agreement at that point was going to allow the board members to earn $20,000 per month.
Yep.
For serving on the board.
Each.
And in his opinion, he said that had never been the case before. So here you are, again, from his point of view. I'm going to be very curious to hear what Phil Gordon says about this. You know, you've got the company in the most disastrous point in its career, not really even operating at this point, I think. You know, trying to find a way to pay players back and overthrowing the board, and then, you know, having to spend $60,000 a month to compensate a board for trying to save the company. And certainly, I think Howard's point of view was, you know, this is just pure greed at this point, right?
Yeah, it's ludicrous. I mean, you're talking about literally $250,000 a year salary that you're taking from the company that owes, you know, nine figures to people around the world. And I think Parvis actually, listen carefully, he actually says, shouldn't that have been the reward enough for these millionaires who were trying to save the company, is saving the company and paying back these players and not being infamous the rest of your life? Shouldn't that have been the reward and your salary, not $60,000 or, you know, a month for the whole three people or whatever it was? And it's right. That's just, if that's true, it's just sickening.
Well, you know, and this is why I really want to hear from Phil Gordon before I get too far down the road here. There seemed to be Howard saying at least that he had the impression that these folks thought that they could actually right the ship. They could turn Full Tilt back into a company that could operate on its own, get out of this mess, and move forward. Where in Howard's mind, after Black Friday, this was a company that needed to be sold. They needed this. They get big investors, pay the players off, get what they could out of it. So if that's really the case, that these new board members thought that they could turn this thing around and continue the company by itself without any outside investors, then I could probably see, you know, hey, now you're just setting the company up for where it's going in the future. I mean, almost every big company pays its directors, and sadly, probably in that same range every month. So that's probably not out of the realm of possibility. It's
the timing of it all.
Bad timing, absolutely.
And I don't know if we were going to talk about this or not in these final categories here, but one of the compelling things for me was when Ray in Dublin tells Howard that there's this backlog of, you know, millions and millions and millions, and that, you know, Howard's reaction is like furious, but he says, you know, let's call Chris in here now, because Chris is there in his home.
Yeah.
And then I want to hear how Chris reacted to that. Obviously, you know, Howard said he was upset. I mean, okay, it's got to be, you find out that you owe nine figures to the world, it's got to be more than upset. So I really want to hear Ferguson's side for that. But that's the point, too, where Bitar says they've actually started to pay it down.
Exactly.
So we don't even know how much they actually owed at one point. It could have been even incredibly worse than this. And they found a processor to pay it down, and that they were starting to get that, retrieve that money or whatever, and fix the backlog problem. So we don't know. Would they have solved that problem? They might have, because Howard admits that Bitar told him that it's getting better. And maybe that was their plan, was that to, okay, it's going to work out, and maybe we do need to find an investor to get the last few hundred million or whatever it is, but it looks like we are going to be able to recoup most of this. And then, of course, what was it, 8 days later was the 15th, because it was April 7th, yeah. I think he said they had that conversation.
To me, that was the key line in all of these interviews that kind of support my hypothesis going, you know, since the beginning of this. And again, this is just Howard's point of view. We need to hear a lot more, but that is consistent with, there's a point where Matthew Parvis asked Howard whether he thought Ray Bitar was qualified as a CEO in a traditional sense. And Howard said, of course not. I mean, he doesn't have any MBA, he didn't run a company before, but he was very passionate about it and, you know, did a good job for a while. Eventually, it seems to me this company got too big. People didn't have the expertise into it. This is a CEO that probably found himself in over his head at some point when the payment processing collapsed and said to himself, you know what, I'm going to solve this problem on my own. I'm not going to need to alert anybody else. I'll figure it out myself. We can debate whether that's right or wrong. And apparently, again, if you believe what Howard's saying, he figured out a way to do it. You know, right. It got big and he said, nope, now we're just paying it down. We've got this figured out. And had Black Friday not happened, it's very possible that he would have got himself out of this jam and no one would have ever known. Now, obviously, that's not saying that eventually it would again and worse, but at least, you know, again, the government ran the clock out on him. And that's where everything happened at this point. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, obviously, you know, I don't think any of us agree that what happened should have happened. And the fact that, you know, Black Friday happened and exposed it. It's probably a good thing, but it doesn't change the fact that it sounds like they thought they found a way out and just ran out of time.
And again, it all goes back to your point of view of how you feel about board members in a major corporation. If you feel that Howard Lederer, Ray First, Chris Ferguson, whatever, these guys should have been right next to Bitar every step of the way, finding out every single day what's going on, day-to-day business or whatever it is, and knowing every nook and cranny of that operation, then none of this is an excuse. It doesn't make any difference. No matter what happened, no matter how it happened, that's not an excuse. But if you're the person who believes, hey, you know what, you have to have trust in your CEO, and if you're a board member, you need to show up for board member meetings and just look at the paperwork they show you and say, okay, all the checks and balances add out by what you're showing me. I have to trust my people, that my people can hire people that are trustworthy to control this stuff. And then these are very well excuses that will make you sleep better at night. And so it just, it all still gets back to that. You know, when he finds out on April 7th, okay, he did find out. Let's say he did find out on April 7th. Is that an excuse, or should he have known on October 2010 that this was happening, or whatever year it was that this started, or whatever? Should he have known this already? And that's the big question in everyone's mind. You have to rectify that with yourself. If you felt like he should have, then whatever he's saying here isn't really going to make you feel any better about the situation. But if you feel like Scott, I think, is thinking that these guys are more figureheads and doing other parts of the business for them. Like, he comes out and says that he was, you know, basically in charge of software and marketing and stuff, and that's what he was focusing his day-to-day operations on, spending, you know, 8-12 hours a day doing that part of the business, that there was no way, and there's no, I think he even mentions in that last interview, Scott, if I'm not wrong or not, but he mentions how there is no requirement for him to do this due diligence as a board member of what Ray is doing or something. I think he does mention
it
somewhere.
Well,
yeah,
right? I mean, this is what I want to say about this. I mean, you're spot on with what you're saying. And what I think, what I'm going to ask those folks that are listening now that are incensed and saying he absolutely needed to know what was going on, I would ask them to definitely watch these videos. And again, it's completely from Howard's point of view. So you got to take that from a grain of salt. But what I would want to ask those people are, okay, what should have Howard or Chris have done to stay on top of this? Because if you watch the videos, Howard says, you know, hey, when the payment processing thing started happening, he asked, were these transactions legal? And he says he was shown letters from the bank that say they were.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Now, maybe there's a forgeries. We don't know. But he would say that. He was getting balance sheets on a regular basis. And we'll talk a little bit later on about this, the segregating player funds. I got the impression that he was asking questions, maybe not as many as he should have, but he was giving information that may or may not have been correct. So that's a really difficult thing, I think, not just in this company or any company, to say, all right, at what point do you say, are you sure this is real?
Right.
I need to actually talk to the banker myself, or do you... I think by nature in a company, you're trusting your employees. So I think to say that, again, from Howard's point of view, that he and Chris were just totally removed from the company and just letting, you know, this guy run amok doesn't seem to be accurate. And then the next question has to say, I mean, how dogged do they need to be in questions when there doesn't seem to be anything really to be dogged about?
Well, that's the other thing. The other thing, too, I think that contributed to this was the fact that they moved the company to Dublin.
Right.
And Batar went to Dublin to run the company while everyone else stayed back in L.A. or Vegas or wherever they lived. And in the beginning, when it was a California LLC, they could be there for pretty much at a moment's notice and start this company and talk about whatever had to be done. But then when the UIGEA happened and they were forced to move out of the company, all of them didn't move out of the company, just the CEO. So here's this guy 6,000 miles away, or whatever it is, and he's finding difficulty running this company, getting in over his head, and he can't just call up and have them come look at the paperwork. You know what I mean? They're a 10-hour plane ride away or whatever it is. So he's trying to fix the problem himself, and that's where it starts to get out of hand. And because the board can't just all of a sudden convene in one location instantly, that he takes it upon himself to try to solve these problems without them. That's the impression I'm getting, and that's what keeps it from Letterer from being able to, or if he was willing to do it, being able to spot these indiscretions or whatever and keep an eye on everything. So moving it out of the country was, I think, was a big thing too.
Well, yeah, I definitely want to talk about the business practices here, because I don't know about you, Chris, but I know when I, at least the first couple videos, I found myself watching it not as a poker player, but as a business owner. You know, yeah. The first couple of videos you're talking about the formation of it. You know, it's a limited liability company. That's exactly what we did. You know, right. You get some people that have this idea. You know, they get a couple friends together, put some money together. They did some good research, but they had no real idea where it was going to go. I mean, that's ante up, right?
Yeah.
You know, and then watching it grow and get big really quickly. And I don't want to be dramatic and say I lay awake at night worrying about this, but I've been very proud of how our company has grown over the last 4 years. And I hope it continues to grow even faster in the future. There's eventually going to get a point when you and I are not qualified to run this company.
Mm.
And we're going to have to find somebody who is, and we're going to have to trust that person.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a very difficult day, I think, for us, you know, because from the beginning, you know, I was talking about this on Fifth Street Radio last night. You know, we've been in business 4 years. We've had our share of disagreements, but the one thing we've never ever disagreed on is that this is our company.
Yeah.
It's 50% you, 50% me, 0% anyone else. And I don't think that's ever going to change. But eventually, you know, if it does get to the point that we can't manage it, we're going to have to bring somebody in. And at that point, then you have to trust. And trust is such a hard thing, isn't it?
Yeah, because trust is built over time. And you can't build over time hiring somebody fresh. How do you know what I mean? You have to literally have someone that you already know and can trust from life's experiences to have that instant trust with the CEO. Otherwise, you can't. You have to, you know, build it with them. And meanwhile, they're running your company for you. How do you trust somebody that you don't know? Which is probably why Ferguson brought in Bitar, because they were friends.
Exactly. Absolutely. Well, and the flip side of that, too, is if you micromanage that person you bring in, you're not going to get a good quality person. Is going to want to come in and take a job over when they know everything they do is going to be scrutinized to the ninth degree. So that's tough. And so, you know, what I kind of saw is, I mean, you really did see a light switch there in the interview when the decision was made to move the company to Dublin. And now, you know, and then all of a sudden you're hiring a lot of people, the things are taking off, and now you're right, you're a complete ocean away from it. And it's tough to keep your fingers on it. And then, you know, the couple times you visited Dublin, that's when you realize, you know, hey, this thing has really grown. I hesitate to say out of control, because I don't think he ever said that. But I think you can say, certainly in hindsight, he's looking back saying it was out of control at that point. And at least out of his control. And that's frustrating, I think, for somebody that's so deeply involved in it from the very beginning.
And I mean, that's one of the reasons why you have a board, is to put the collective brain power together to make the proper decisions. And then the CEO at that point is sort of like the one who, not the arbitrator, but he's kind of the one that filters it. And then they let him know, this is what we need to do. And then he you know, executes it or whatever. And that's why you have a board, to help someone who might be in over their head, or a figurehead, or whatever you want to call it. So, and I could probably see that's probably maybe a way that our company would go someday if we were that successful.
You know, absolutely. It's exactly how it's going to have to go.
So,
but it's not going to be easy.
No, I know.
And certainly watching these videos, it makes it even harder, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, because the last thing we want to do, or any company wants to do, is find themselves in the same situation at some point where... You know, I think the other thing, too, you saw this, too, is... When a company is growing so quickly and so successfully, which that company was, you don't necessarily want to be the one that's putting the brakes on it.
Yeah,
you just kind of want to ride the rush. You're going, well, let's not worry about it. And unfortunately, that's the time that you should be worried about it, because when it falls over the cliff, it's too late to go back. You know, I also thought, you know, a lot of this was, you know, I'm thinking of, I don't know if you saw the movie Social Network about Facebook, you know.
Yeah, I did.
But there's some parallels there, too, I thought. You know, two buddies in their college dorm starting it, and next thing you know, the one buddy is coming out to California, and every time he comes out, the office is bigger.
Yeah.
And he's signing new contracts, and there's new employees, and, you know, I saw the same thing, and of course that was a movie, a dramatic movie, obviously, but you saw the same thing in his eyes as you did Howard's eyes watching this, that eventually this thing just, at some point, it got out of control. And couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
Now, I did want to get back to this idea of segregating player funds, because this was always very contentious. And I think Howard kind of explained this in a very simple manner that some people were ignoring. Now, I want to say, obviously, going forward, every site should have a segregated player account. This should never be an issue anymore, and that's one of the great things to come out of this, is really making sure that that's important. But you know, even Matt Parvis alluded to this in his questioning. He's like, you know, hey, in the infancy of online poker, maybe no company was thinking about segregating player funds. But here's what's always kind of bothered me about the players that have been absolutely outraged that there wasn't a segregated player fund. You know, as Howard explained it, he's like, you know, hey, we had a bunch of bank accounts, we had a bunch of money, we've given balance sheets. As long as the money that we had in all of our accounts exceeded the amount of money that we owed players, there should have never been a problem. And I guess what I want to say about that, I'm curious, is you ask, I don't think I'm being dramatic, you ask 90% of U.S. households how they handle their personal finances in their household, and I think that's exactly what they would say they do. You know, if I decide I want to buy a new TV, I look at my bank accounts, I decide how much money I have, I look at my credit cards, how much I owe, I look ahead to know what bills I'm coming in, and if it all adds up and subtracts, and I've got $500 left, guess what? I feel justified in buying a $500 TV. Now, that may not be the smartest thing to do, but I think that's what a lot of households do, and that's exactly what Full Tilt did, and I don't think they should be vilified for it as much as they have been. Obviously, at some point, the company got big enough that someone should have been smart enough to suggest this, but in the early stages, I'm not as quick to attack them for doing something that I think most everybody else does. Yes, I knew we'd finally get to a point where we disagreed.
Well, the only thing is that it's not their money. That's the thing. You gave your analogy, but again, it was all your debt and your money that you were making this analogy to. This isn't their money.
That's a good point.
They shouldn't be covering other people's money with their own money and thinking that that's all they need to do. It's not their money. It's just not their money. It never was their money, and it never could be their money.
It's a simple addition problem, though. If
I understand that. But
$100 million to players, and they have $101 million in their bank accounts, it's really $1 million is what they have.
You just got to think. You would have to think that somebody that you hired to do finance for you, CFO, whatever, would have to look at that and say, you're mingling accounts here now. You're saying that I can transfer money from our account into their accounts to cover their balances. And then that says, okay, well, then in turn, does that mean we can use their money to do what we want with too? Because you have free access to those accounts with your own accounts? To me, it just looks like it's a nightmare. Any CFO would look at that and say, we can't do this, I would think.
I don't know about any. I'm not trying to say this is the right way to do it. Obviously, a segregated player account is the absolute way that this should have been done and should always be done from here on out. But again, I mean, the point is, as long as they have the money to cover what they owe, that should be what's important. Not necessarily whether it's in this actual account here versus this account here. And that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about having two bank accounts instead of one bank account.
Well, the other thing, too, right? Is that when you say owe, they shouldn't owe them anything. You know what I mean? It's their money, and it should be their money and their accounts, and we don't owe them anything.
Well, no one owes it. That's not what I meant. What I meant to say is, if there's $100 million in play on the site, they have to be able to cover $100 million.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And if they have $101 million in their bank account, they have it covered. It doesn't matter whether they take that $100 million and put it in a second bank account and keep $1 million in a different bank account. It's still the same amount of money, right?
No, I know.
They're not
using
anything.
I know what you're saying.
It's completely different if they say, hey, we're going to spend $50 million for the next 2 months and just hope that there's not a run on the bank.
Right.
That's completely different.
Right, I mean, it's the same thing you talked about before with the FDIC guaranteeing everybody's money, but if everyone in the world ran down to the bank today and demanded every dime they had in their account, they couldn't pay them.
Exactly, and that's completely different. I shouldn't say completely different, because you're talking about banking there, and banking,
right, but I know what you're saying.
Is to take people's money and loan it out, but and not an online poker site is not that. But I'm going to need somebody to really convince me that there's something different about having two bank accounts where you put 100 million in and 1 million in the other versus one bank account with 101 million. It's semantics to me, I think.
Well, let me ask you something. And somewhere along the way, I got the impression that you weren't allowed to get a license unless you said that you had segregated accounts.
Well, I mean, this was the problem here, is they had two different gaming commissions.
Right.
The gaming Alderney. Commission that oversaw PokerStars insisted on segregated player account that was guaranteed, where Alderney never did.
Okay.
And, you know, so that's that to me, it's one of the more fascinating things about this, is had PokerStars, regulatory agency, not required that, would PokerStars have done it? You know, we'll never know. You know, if your regulatory says you have to do it this way, you do it that way or you lose your license. Now, obviously, there's some companies that don't do the lowest common denominator. They are much better run and say, hey, we're going to build in additional safeguards. And maybe PokerStars was already doing that. I don't know. But, and, you know, obviously, if Alderney would have insisted on Full Tilt doing that, I would like to think that would have happened. And that's a problem. That they didn't, but you know, again, that comes down to a regulatory thing at that point. But
yeah.
Again, at the bottom, at the end of the day, it's simple math. As long as you have enough money to cover your debts, whatever's left is—I mean, there's no, you know, financial problem. I don't think using whatever money is left, as long as you can cover what you owe. It doesn't matter where account is in, but. But we don't need to. I mean, that's a very small part. I didn't think we were going to go that far on it. But related, there was a point where, you know, Parvis mentioned a comment from the DOJ report that said, in response to a customer, Ray Bitar said that the Full Tilt, and I'm paraphrasing here, Full Tilt is not a bank, and player funds are never guaranteed.
Right. What? And on this note, I put the word context.
Yeah.
Because I think Letterer at that point says, well, what he's saying is that we're in the Wild Wild West here and anything could happen. The government could seize your money and we can't guarantee your money. So he's not, in essence, saying, oh, we could steal your money. It's not guaranteed. He's saying that something could happen to the company and your money could be frozen. You know that, so it's in context. You can't take it as he's saying to you, "Oh, your money's in danger because we're crooked people." He's saying anything could happen to our company. The government could say, "You know, you know full well about the UIGEA, and yet you're choosing to play on our site." So if anything happens by the government's eyes, you could lose your money, and we can't guarantee it because we're not a bank.
Yeah, and that's the reason I put it on the notes, because I want to talk about it. Again, I'm not trying to be an apologist at all here, but I think that's the type of comment that is easily, as you mentioned, taken out of context.
Yeah.
And making it sound like, you know, hey, they're flying around the country on lavish dinners on your money, and if they end up not being able to cover it, oopsie, too bad, you trusted us. Whereas with the bank, it is federally insured. So even if the bank goes out of business, your money is protected. That, you know, it's not the case here. And as you said, you're right. I mean, no one at that point, I think, ever anticipated Black Friday. But that's exactly what the comment was meant to convey, is that, you know, hey, if the world ends tomorrow and blows up, guess what? In the afterlife, don't come back and ask for your money, because it's not going to be there.
Right.
It's not guaranteed. So, but I can certainly see where a comment like that would get people hot and bothered, and I don't necessarily think they should have.
It did feel like Parvis was bringing that up because he felt that way.
Well,
other way.
It probably could have been, but I think he was a good interviewer in the sense that he was asking the questions that I think a lot of players are asking.
Right.
And I could very much see a lot of players asking that. If you got that, again, I mean, I don't spend a lot of time on 2+2, but I can imagine you get that kind of response from an online poker site, that's going on 2+2. And 400 posts by the next morning,
right?
Saying this is ridiculous, and because people don't stop to think of it one step further, it's a knee-jerk reaction of these guys are saying my money's not guaranteed, when it's not exactly what they're saying. You know what they're saying is, you know, as a company, we're doing everything we can to protect it, which may or may not have been true. Obviously, it wasn't at that point, but you know, there's outside forces in the world that may not allow us to guarantee that. It's all, you know, it's all in the interpretation. But all right, well, let's kind of wrap up here. A couple last thing I thought that I thought was very interesting. You know, we mentioned earlier in the show that Howard gave us very good explanation of what the
backlog.
Right. How that actually worked and how hard it was to actually figure it out based on people, you know, depositing and winning money and losing money. And they said by the time they unraveled that onion, I think it was somewhere an estimation of $135, $150 million that they never actually pulled from people's bank accounts, right? And they were trying to figure out how much of that they thought they could actually recover when they're trying to figure out just how big of a hole they're in. And Howard said he and Chris were thinking maybe $70 million or so. And it came back, they determined it was $10
million. Yeah.
And what that means is, as Howard said, and it makes perfect sense, is there were just a lot of bad players.
Yeah.
You know, people that were putting money on the site and just immediately losing it. And then once it's lost and someone's withdrawing it, then it's gone.
Yeah, now Full Tilt's on the hook for it.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought that, to me, that was a pretty staggering damnation of the quality of players online. And I think that's what we've seen. You know, we talked about this on the show a couple months ago, that we're now finally seeing the effects of Black Friday, where all that money that was generated by the poker economy, by your kitchen table players online, that feeds up on the online economy, is gone now. And you're not getting those kitchen table players in brick and mortar rooms because you can't play for 5 cents, 10 cents.
Yeah.
At your local room, you gotta, you know, play for $1, $2 at the minimum, and that's gone. And this exactly proves how powerful that is. I mean, you know, anywhere from 125 to 140 million gone from bad players.
And he said it was the greatest argument for skill versus luck.
Yeah,
I mean, it absolutely shows you that there are these people who are just pouring money and money and it so quickly they were losing it because they weren't quality skilled players, and the ones who were taking it from them. And it was shocking when he said that only 10 was recoverable. I was like, wow.
Now there is a double advocates thing I thought about this into, is that for the there was a series of months where people were starting to post on 2+2, and actually Howard even mentioned that he was surprised there weren't more people posting, but it was probably because they realized, you know, hey, I deposited money on Full Tilt, it never came out of my bank account. I waited a month, it never had. I tried it again, it didn't happen again. I'm not going to tell anyone. In fact, actually, I'm surprised somebody actually did post it. And at that point, if you realize, hey, they're never going to pull this out of my bank account, now you're playing with free money, right?
Yeah.
I mean, why not dump a bunch of money on there? Hope, go into a nosebleed game that you can't afford, take a shot, get lucky, and then withdraw it. You know, it's a free shot at riches. I imagine some of that contributed to that. It wasn't all just pure bad play. It was, you know, some opportunistic shots being taken. I don't think it was too much, but I mean, I can certainly see that, right?
Sure. And the other thing, too, is when you're watching these videos, there are going to be moments where you're going to be like, well, wasn't that a red flag, Howard?
Yeah.
And shouldn't you have done something then? But I guess the other thing you could think about, too, is when you talk about how many people were on his site, you know, it's six figures of how many people were on that site who registered, who made deposits. He said alone it was like 130,000 people who had put funds on the site that never got withdrawn. So right. That's just the people who didn't get money withdrawn.
Yeah.
Not to mention
yeah.
the people who did. So when you think about how many people are on the site, how many people are depositing and withdrawing every single moment of every single day, when someone walks up to him at the World Series and says, hey, Howard, I want to let you know that I deposited 100 on the site, but it never came out of a bank account, and then I lost it. And Howard says, you know, Howard says to himself internally, you know, hey, that's one out of 300,000 people.
Yeah.
That's a glitch. Hey, we're making billions of dollars. We can afford to pay that $100 that guy deposited, and it's just a business mistake or something in cyberspace happened or whatever, and he doesn't think anything of it. And he said there were a few occasions where people come up to him and talk to him about something like that. So when you're watching this video, you're going to say that, and you're going to say, oh my God, why didn't he investigate? Or the email from the guy who wants to know if his accounts are segregated, and they can't produce a document saying it is. Something like that. And
yeah.
and so there's going to be all these little flags that go up throughout these videos as you're watching them. and you know, and it is what it is. And he admits to that he made some huge mistakes. One of the mistakes he said that what was the biggest mistake he said he made, Scott, was that when they, it was at the end of the fifth.
Yeah, well, it was. I think this last video, he said the biggest mistake he was is not putting an end to the circus over
The silliness. He said
the board. Yeah. I mean, obviously, he admitted that he made a ton of mistakes, and you know, to his credit, that he can admit that. And you know, I think some of them were mistakes that he probably didn't realize at the time were happening. And obviously, it's very easy for people now to go back and look at it and point it out. But there certainly seemed to be a lot of things going on that might have made it a little more difficult at the time. But I mean, your point about the anecdotal stories. To me, you know, again, I'm not a big fan of 2+2 posting and that, but the advantage of it is it consolidates those anecdotes and gives you a trend at that point.
Yeah.
You know, if it wasn't for 2+2, we would have never figured out the whole, you know, UB scandal. And I think that's important, and we're starting to see that with Twitter and Facebook and some of this other stuff, that companies are now being able to kind of consolidate some of those anecdotes and really find out where the trends are and what things they need to look at, because it's hard with a big company to track down every single thing you hear from a different customer. But when you hear it 10 times, 100 times, 100,000 times, all of a sudden, now you realize there's something really behind it.
Yeah.
All right, well, hey, it was very fascinating. I really encourage people to go back and watch them themselves and make your own judgments. Like I said, there's at least probably one more, if not a couple more, coming out. Watch them. And I would love to get some kind of discussion going on the forum about it, because I'm sure our listeners have some of their own thoughts that are very different from ours. And there's a lot of room for discussion.
Yeah, and a lot to dissect.
Absolutely.
Lot of stuff. And just one last thought is, I thought that there was a lot of pressure on Parvis to do this. Not to do it, but
absolutely.
There's a lot of pressure on him to be the one that gets to talk to this guy and to do it. And I thought he did a hell of a job. You know, him and his crew, however they, you know, came about these questions and answers and stuff. And I thought he did a real good job with it. And it's not easy to be that person. It's not easy to be David Frost, so.
No. Okay, we got an audio situation this week, Chris.
Does that mean the situation's on the show and he called in? I don't understand.
No, he got canceled.
Oh, he was canceled, all right.
This is Ross from Indiana. Bless his heart, he tried to call the hotline and muffed it. He's the first one in history to muff his call to the hotline.
Oh, yeah. No one's ever done that before.
No, of course not. And then re-recorded and sent it to us through his own means. And, you know, he says, we'll roll the clip here in a minute. He says he doesn't think it's a hand of the week or even situation worthy. Obviously, or at least I disagree. We'll find out what you think. But it is. It's a good situation from, I think, a lot of players run into in their home games. So let's roll the clip.
Hi, Chris and Scott. This is Ross from Indiana. I had kind of a question/situation of the week thing for you. It's not worthy of hand of the week or anything, I don't think, but I'll just throw it at you. If you want to use it, that's great. I play in a pretty regular home game, play cash game style, but we're all pretty much newlyweds, and we just like poker, so we try to keep it cheap at $5 max buy-in, 5 10-cent blinds. So, the situation is I'm in the small blind with pocket 10s, and I know they're just 10s, but it limps around to me. I raise about 5x, which is standard in this game. It folds around to the button, who's the guy at the table that I played with by far the most. He shoves immediately and he has me covered. He's about $15, I have about $12. We're the two big stacks at the table. When he does this, he's done this before to me, and it makes me almost 100% sure he's got ace king or ace queen. Definitely two overs, probably not a pocket pair. And I know this, and so I was just at a point where I wasn't sure whether or not with the tens to simply prove that I could not be shoved off a hand, even though I know it's a coin flip, if there's any equity in making a call just to prove that I am not a sissy, basically, or if it makes sense to fold and just live to fight another day. There were a couple new guys there that I felt I needed to prove this to in the end, so I did make the call, and he sure enough flipped over ace-king off, flops an ace, I'm out. And I promise I'm not telling you this just because it's a bad beat, but I am curious if there's any validity to my thinking that I need to make the call just to prove I can't be pushed off a hand. So, anyway, I love the podcast. Keep up the great work, and thanks very much.
Well, I think that the issue at hand here is eerily similar to Scott talking about defending the small blind and the mystery earlier, the O'Malley's.
It's funny how these shows kind of have.
Yeah, they kind of dovetail with each other.
It's almost like somebody's planning these shows.
To be the macho guy who has to not be pushed around.
You can't be macho if you're not going to use the voice.
He's not going to be pushed around. Pay that man his money.
That's like Sean Connery with a stutter.
But I really think that if you're buying in for $5 and you've got 15 in front of you or 12 or whatever it is and you have 10s and the guy shoves on you, yeah, just move on. I mean, I don't see how he was trying to take a stand to prove to other players that he would take a stand, but, you know, and then he also says, I didn't want to call in and say it was a bad beat. Well, it's not a bad beat. It was a race. Races aren't bad beats. Bad beats are when there's one out to beat you or whatever, and yeah, it comes. Exactly. This is a, you know, a race 50-50, and they flopped you. So
good thing, Ross, you don't owe Chris a dollar now.
That's right. It's not a bad beat, so I'm not making any money on this show this week. But, you know, I would never risk my whole stack with 10s to prove a point.
Yeah. Well, you know, we get into this a lot. this question comes up at least once a year, if not more often, sometime on our show. You know, how do you play against a maniac? And I'm not saying this person's a maniac here, but this particular play is maniacal, right?
Yeah.
You know, someone's raised to 50 cents, I think, right? They said they're playing nickel dime lines, so he raises 5x, 50 cents, it comes back to you, you shove for $15. Right? And there's no way around it. It's maniacal. You know, it's the same situation in the World Series thing you're talking about. It's maniacal at that point.
They raised 1,500 times the big blind.
Yeah. So, how do you play against that person? Well, you got two choices. You can get down the mud with them and call a bluff and know and really alter your game and do something that you would never, ever do. I mean, whoever calls off all that kind of money on one hand pre-flop, ever.
Right.
Or you can let them continue to abuse you, take 50 cents here, a dime here, and eventually that kind of move is going to burn them. At some point, you're going to wake up with aces or kings or somebody else at the table. It's going to call that person and shut them down. But you don't have to be the table sheriff, and particularly not with tens. You know, I know he's trying to figure out what's going on. I mean, it could be a very effective play for the button to do this, knowing that if you're playing a that what I'm just saying on the show here now, I'm just not going to do it. And he knows he's going to be able to take that 50 cents from me every time. But eventually it's going to catch up. I mean, how many times has he has to do that before you catch him once and you get all that money back?
Yeah.
We're talking 50 cents here, right?
Yeah.
And he took $12 from us. So 24 times.
Yep.
He has to get away with that move for it to be profitable. 24 times.
That's a great point. And the other thing, too, is he puts them on hands, you know, and he's like, you know, it could be a pair, it could be ace-king, ace-queen. Well, every think about how many hands are racing against you with overs. There's so many combinations. And then how many hands have you crushed?
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. Aces, kings, queens, and jacks have you crushed. Ace-king, ace-queen, ace-jack, ace-ten, or ace-ten, but ace-ten still has an ace over card, but two overs, ace-king, ace-queen, king-queen, king-jack. You know what I mean? It's just jack queen. There's so many combinations that you're risking your entire stack on a 50-50, likely. Or it could be even worse. It could be 80-20 or whatever you want to call it. You know, I mean, 90-11 or whatever. I mean, it's just crazy to put all your stack in there to prove a point and hope at best you're racing. It's just
yeah, that's
not.
I mean, you not only have to be right here, you have to hold up.
Exactly.
You could have seven deuce and still beat you in this hand.
Yep. Yep.
you know, the other thing too, I guess, is just, you know, let somebody else take the shot at this guy. You know, why do you have to be the one that does it? You know, it's a high risk, high reward. Let somebody else take the shot. Obviously, if they win, they're going to get the rewards of taking that risk. But it just doesn't outweigh the risk of your own stack. I mean, you're the second biggest stack at the table, you said, right? $12, $15, you've more than doubled your buy-in. You're playing well. Why throw it away on one hand? And to me, this is another one of those big explanations of why poker is a game of skill versus luck, and someone throwing that out the window. Turning a game of skill where you have obviously proved that you can beat this game, you've more than doubled your buy-in, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden you're going to throw that all away and say, all right, I'm just going to take a chance here.
Exactly.
Why would you do that? Why would anybody want to do that in this game, you know? Let the other guy obviously is, for the most part, doing that. I mean, there's some strategy involved in shoving $15 here, knowing that it's unlikely anybody's going to call you. But if somebody does, then you're in peril. So I don't necessarily think it's a long-term strategy that works out. He's playing luck.
Plus, I mean, there are ways to exploit the table image of being a pushover. There are ways to do that and not have to combat it. Now all of a sudden they can't push you around, so you're not going to catch anybody in bluffs. You're not going to get paid off. You know what I mean? If you're one who gets to be pushed around, then when you have the nuts and you bet a little bit, they may try to force you off the hand because they know they could push you around, and now you've got the nuts and you call and you make more money that way. So it's not necessarily a bad thing to have that table image of being a pushover, because you might get paid off.
Absolutely. And you know what we're talking about here too is, and we're talking pre-flop here, there's no reason you have to play this guy pre-flop.
Right.
In this particular hand, he didn't go all in until you gave them the opportunity to do. When it got to you, you could have easily just called the small blind and taken a flyer. Now, that's not optimal playing against non-maniacs, but against this kind of guy, I'm never going to give him an opportunity to push me off of a hand like tens. I am going to take my chances that I'm going to, you know, flop a set or straight draw or something, not just with tens, but with any of my hands. And then I've got a lot more ammunition to take this guy down with. At that point, if I have a total made hand on the flop and he goes crazy, then it's a lot easier for me to make that call. I mean, it's even tough, I think, pre-flop to make this call with aces. It would, but then you think about kings, it's a little harder. Queens gets even harder. Jacks, it gets even harder. Now tens is really hard. You know, let's battle them when we have a lot more information on our hand. You know,
absolutely.
It's a long night. You know, we're playing.
And you're beating the game. You're beating the game.
All right, I guess we're done, right?
Yeah, it's fine. Let's give him something. And it's a long show. We had a lot to talk about.
All right, Ross, we appreciate you calling in. Hopefully next time you'll find another way to beat this villain. But in the meantime, you can soften his heart with the classic tournament dealer button from tournamentbutton.com, which we're going to send you. You can use in your home game. Tournamentbutton.com offers a variety of home dealer buttons with timers built right into them. You can even customize them with your own photo or logo. And ask about the Anti-Up logo version. And also, when you order on their site, use the code ANTIUP and you get free shipping.
All right, don't forget to tune in next week. Got a pretty big announcement. And then the week after that's going to be our Superfan show. So some really good stuff coming up. And I'm sure we'll have some more thoughts on the letter or files, whatever gets produced for our viewing pleasure. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
AnteUp is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnteUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnteUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.